There is a hypervigilance that one utilizes in order to find out what is and what isn't acceptable. But what is never really talked about is the exhaustion, right? When folks say, I want to bring more of myself into the workplace, what they're saying is, I'm tired of having to be conscious of the things that I can't bring. Because if I'm doing that labor of figuring out what you will and won't accept, that's energy I'm not utilizing to do my actual job.
This is Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter. I'm your host, Dr. Cindy Pace, Vice President and Global Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer at MetLife. Our podcast examines the pivotal role people play in creating inclusive workplaces that are built for the future. How does inclusion impact our well-being? Why is it a business imperative? In each episode, we weave together storytelling and research-driven conversations with globally recognized authors, experts, and DEI practitioners. On the show, we tackle steps that each of us can take to advance DEI. We've had an amazing season so far, but our next guest will take us on a very critical moment of self-reflection. Wade Davis is the Vice President of Inclusion Strategy for Product at Netflix. If you don't know Wade, I'm fairly confident that after today's episode, you'll know him quite well and you'll want to keep listening to him. And it's not only because he is such a magnetic storyteller. Wade has taken all of his experiences and is now using them as a DEI practitioner to teach other people how to learn from discomfort. In this episode, we talked about the power of feminism and the language of DEI. We also talked about hypervigilance, the difference between niceness and kindness, and about making inclusion personal.
So I'm a Southerner, as you might remember. I was born in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm,
I spent most of my adolescence in Shreveport, Louisiana. And I'm a church boy, so I went to church constantly, you know, 5 and 6 days per week. And I think going to church so much helped, you know, me as an orator, as a storyteller. As you know, the Black church is a place where the preacher, right, is one that has to tell captivating stories in order to get, you know, folks to engage. And I think unconsciously that seeped into who I am. I moved to Colorado when I was, I think, around the age of 12 or 13. My mother, she remarried and we moved to Colorado. So I was kind of a Southern Mountain West mutt. But what's important about that is, moving from Shreveport to Denver was the first time I truly engaged with white people on a much more personal level. Cause where I lived in Shreveport, there were literally no white people around me. So coming face to face with people who I only saw on TV or in a grocery store from time to time, but truly having real relationships, I think has stuck with me, right? That the work that I do is about bringing people from different worlds together, but being able to see yourself in the other person, which I think is the hardest thing to do when you've been kept apart for so long. The other thing that's really important for me is I grew up with a speech impediment. So I was a kid who had a really bad stutter. And that caused me to live in my own head a lot, right? I didn't want to talk. I was afraid to talk because if I did, someone would make fun of me or what have you. So I think that those two things really forced me to be an observer of the world in really interesting ways. And then once I started to understand that I was a really great football player, that was my respite from the world, right? I didn't have to worry about how white people may have thought of me. I didn't have to worry about what people who just thought of me in general because of my speech impediment. So it was a place where I could just live underneath my helmet. I could use all of my God-given talents And I thought that that was the way that I was going to make it in the world, because I didn't want to speak, you know. The negative aspect of that, though, is when you are a Black athlete, the world oftentimes thinks that you're not intelligent. So I also had that kind of burden that I was trying to figure out how to work through. So I would say that around the age of, 15 or 16, when I realized that I was LGBT, then I was like, I got the quadfecta, right? I got every potential burden someone might want to have. But I always felt strong. And I don't know if that's helpful to say, right? But all of those things that came at me at once, I still never felt as if I had to give up or as if I wasn't going to somehow make it through. And I think the church helped inculcate that inside of me. Mm-hmm. I wasn't overly or overtly religious, but I believe that the church gave me a sense of internal strength and a sense of self that really helped me to become who I am now.
That's really powerful, Wade. And, you know, I'm finding that the more that I speak to leaders from various backgrounds, there's some source of faith or spiritual centering alignment that has happened in their lives that keeps them fulfilled, keeps them encouraged, inspired, and motivated to continue to live and work in their purpose. When I hear you talk about the church, so there are a couple of things I don't think I knew that I now know. I knew you were from Louisiana, so we both share the South. I was actually born in Savannah, so I call myself the Low Country girl, you know, but I was raised in Atlanta, so I don't even remember the Low Country. I just want to have my connection to the Low Country.
I didn't know you were from Savannah. Wow.
Yeah, I was born in Savannah and I was raised in Atlanta as a very, very like young baby. So okay. It's one of those things where I try to like make that my origin. I'm very connected to that area. But I think the thing that we share, Shreveport for you, Louisiana, and Savannah and Atlanta are certain types of southern towns that have cultural ways.
Oh, yes.
And the church, to your point, very important to, you know, a sense of refuge, building a faith and those kinds of things. In addition, a place, a platform to become great speakers.
Yeah.
So when I was a kid, not that I wanted to be on stage, but that's what you did. It was called being on program. You were going to be on program.
Oh, yes.
I'd rather be sitting with my friends, but that awareness that something is in you. I was wondering for you, did the ability to overcome and work on your speech impediment, was any of that done through the church, or did you do that on your own accord through coaching? How did you address not just having, you know, the stammer, but also the confidence? What was your method?
Yeah. So in elementary school and in middle school, I was in speech therapy. And what I don't remember was, did I enjoy it? I remember being ashamed that I would have to go during lunchtime when all the other kids, to your point, were in cafeteria playing outside or what have you, but I had to go upstairs. Now, the one thing that I think the school did smartly was the room was unmarked. So it wasn't like my friends knew that I was going to learn how to talk, but kids can be ruthless, you know, because they don't know any difference. And your parents oftentimes haven't talked to you about the idea that other people speak differently, right? Mm-hmm. The way that I thought of it was that I was never going to actually make it because, you know, there were moments where I could talk relatively fluently, but then I would get nervous, I would get super excited. And what my speech therapist wanted me to do was to slow down and to breathe properly. But, you know, I'm 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. I don't know how to do any of those things well. The strange thing about my speech impediment and my stammer is as I got more confidence in myself through the venue of sports and actually just to be honest, I just stopped caring about what people thought about my stutter. And I was just like, I don't care. Like, it's who I am. There's nothing I can do about it. And slowly it got better. I learned about how to control my breathing. The interesting thing about a stutter, though, is that I learned when I was in my 20s, because I did a lot of reading about it, is the only way to actually truly overcome your stutter is to stutter.
Okay. Right?
Is to get comfortable with the fact that you stutter,
mm-hmm.
and just to go right through it. Because if you're trying to mask it or hide it, what you do is you end up causing your stutter to be even more prominent. And there's this old adage that the only way out is to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what is true for your stutter.
You know, Wade, when we talk about diversity and checking boxes, you check like 10 boxes. And listen, okay, you are definitely counted in the representation. So a couple of things, I mean, I could unpack so much. This is just ripe with you know, exploring. Being a Black kid from Shreveport, moving to Denver, playing football, being great at it, going to the NFL, and being gay. We have to hear a little bit about that journey and then how you took all of these things, managing your stutter through speech therapy, getting great at sports, and also becoming more and more observant of the world. So we're dealing with disability, sexual orientation, race, because you are a Black man in America, but specifically Southern, gay, grew up in the church.
So there's class
NFL.
Too.
Yeah. Okay, we got to talk about that. Now, you know, I cannot do a run pass. How did you navigate that? And how did it get you here to teaching us and being a thought leader in this space?
Yeah. So I didn't realize I was gay. Like, and this is going to sound strange because mm-hmm. most people have a glimpse or an understanding that they're gay earlier. But I didn't realize I was attracted to other boys until I was in high school. And I remember being in high school, looking at this other kid, just thinking, wow, he's attractive. He's cute. He's beautiful. And then immediately knowing with great clarity that the thought that I just had, I could never have again. Like there was no one who needed to tell. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a way where like no one was overtly homophobic towards gay men. Now, my grandfather, I remember being inside of a mall and we saw two women, and my grandfather talked about them as if they were lesbians. Now, he didn't say the word lesbian, but he called them bulldaggers. And I remember going, oh, I never heard that term before, right? And the only thing that I could surmise that made them different from other women that he had never called a bulldagger was in their dress and in their haircut. You know, their haircut was much shorter than most women during my childhood. And they dressed, you know, and again, at that time, I didn't have the language, but they dressed much more masculine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather never let my mother wear skirts that weren't below her knee, and she could not wear pants. So he, in a lot of ways, inculcated in me a certain, like, let's call it like gender performance that women had to have and that men had to have. So when I realized that I was gay, I immediately started to perform a certain type of gender. So I would wear oversized pants. I was like a 28 waist, but I was wearing size 36 pants. I was wearing a t-shirt that was a medium, you know, a mix between a small and a medium, but I was wearing triple X t-shirts, trying to perform a certain type of rugged masculinity because all of the boys around me dressed a certain way. And I knew that I needed to fit in, right?
Okay.
And the only way to fit in was to mimic what I saw all the other boys wearing. And I heightened that type of dress when I realized that I was attracted to other boys. And, you know, at that time, adolescence is an incoherent time in general. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't sure if I was bi, if it was just a glitch in the matrix, right? So when I entered into the NFL, I had learned how to hide who I was.
Mm-hmm.
I knew how to perform a certain type of stereotypical masculinity where I was concerned about being thought of as gay, but not too much. Because it wasn't hard to perform heterosexuality, mm-hmm. the thing that was hard was compartmentalizing the different parts of myself, okay. right? It was also hard lying to everybody, especially women, you know, because I was dating women. I had a girlfriend in college for 2 years who I loved as much as I could love someone of the opposite sex. Mm-hmm. But it was two things that were going on. It was trying to get the most out of my body and my mind, you know, in that college space. But it was also trying to kill off a part of me that I thought the world would never accept.
I mean, that brought tears to my eyes, Wade. To kill off a part of me because the world won't accept it. And, you know, this is your workplace. You know, we talk about bringing our full selves to work. You were not able to do that in the sport that you loved, that you had trained so hard for. Here you are having to perform, as you would say, hold back and even want to fully damage and get rid of parts of yourself that can't come to the surface. Was it in your mind that you thought, if they find out, that's it, my career is over? Were there indications or signs, or was that just your own, the way that you made meaning of this experience that you were having?
Yeah, so the simplest way to answer that is no one in the NFL specifically was ever overtly homophobic. Mm-hmm. In college, they definitely were. And in high school, they were even more, right? But it was more the mundane forms of homophobia. And I'm going to include sexism in that too, mm-hmm. right? That made me believe that if the world knew that I was gay, I would be discarded everywhere. It just wasn't in the sports world. Okay. It was in public places, right? Because you have to remember, this is the late 90s and the early 2000s, where there was an absence of visibility, there was an absence of representation, there was an absence of just education, mm-hmm. right? And gay people and straight people, the twain didn't meet as much as it does now, right? Like, everyone had a gay aunt or a gay uncle, right? Or someone who they knew was gay, but there were no real public conversations to challenge the perception of what it meant to be gay. So mm-hmm. I just assumed that if someone found out that I would be gay, that they would love me, right? But part of the reason why that is so heavy for me at the time was because I really didn't love myself, right? So because I didn't have a good sense of myself, I was hyper concerned about what others thought about me. The last thing that I'll say is, when you are not out, and I'm intentionally not using the language of in the closet, because I actually find that language very dehumanizing for LGBTQ folks. Mm. I was hypervigilant, right? I was always watching how everyone responded to things that I did. So I'm watching if I sat a certain way, how someone looked at me, right? Like, their subtle body language was actually instructive to what I thought would be acceptable. Right. So I would sit with my legs crossed like a stereotypical man did. And I wouldn't sit like a stereotypical woman does. But the way that women sit historically is actually much more comfortable on your hip, actually, mm-hmm. you know. And I remember watching an interview with a wide receiver for the Dallas Cowboys named Michael Irvin. And he was sitting with his legs crossed historically like women do. And I was shocked that no one called him gay. I was, because in my mind, if I ever sat that way, someone would look at me and go, oh, he must be gay, right? So the level of hypervigilance that I existed with mm-hmm. during that time of my life was so, so exhausting. So when I think about folks in the corporate world, right, whether you're Black, you're disabled, you're a woman, there is a hypervigilance that one utilizes in order to find out what is and what isn't acceptable.
What Wade is describing is called covering. And there's a professor at NYU, Kenji Yoshino, who wrote a book on the topic called Covering, The Hidden Assault on Our Civil Rights. It's the idea that to be included and accepted,
people have to downplay their differences. People who are ethnically and racially diverse feeling that they have to act more white, or people with different abilities feeling like they have to hide them.
But what is never really talked about is the exhaustion, right? Imagine if I didn't have to do all of those things to figure out if I could be accepted, right? What other things could I be doing with my mental capacity, right? And
exactly.
And that's the piece that I think that people don't get when folks say, I want to bring more of myself into the workplace. What they're saying is, I'm tired of having to be conscious of the things that I can't bring. Because
right.
If I'm doing that labor of figuring out what you will and won't accept, that's energy I'm not utilizing to do my actual job.
Exactly. And many of us cover in some regard in the workplace to be accepted. But to your point, the hypervigilance when it comes to race, gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, age, disability is tremendous. And we have no idea. I always say, you have no idea what people are dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just look at someone and think that you understand. So thank you for sharing that, Wade, because I think sharing these in-depth elements of your experience can be helpful, not only from a learning perspective, but from a connection perspective. And we've been talking a lot about connection and relationships over the past several episodes. I want to pivot to, at what point in your career, transitioning from the NFL into being this DEI thought leader and consultant, what was the calling there? I know all the elements that we've just talked about go into you being able to truly and fully be authentic in this space. And you are one of the best, I have to say. How did that work? Like, okay, when I'm done with football, I'm going to be a consultant to Fortune 50, Fortune 500 companies. How did that come together for you to become a DEI practitioner?
Yeah. So I got fired from a sales job. I was working for a company called Zoom Media, and I stunk. I didn't want to go out and beg people to sign up with us. So I would just go to work every day and make up companies that I was going to do sales calls with or trips with. And finally, my supervisor, he called me to his office and he said, Wade, what do you do here? And we both just started dying.
What is your job?
Because the truth, what is your job, right? And he said, look, we're going to let you go. But they gave me a severance package. So I was like, you're going to give me money to leave here? And I didn't do nothing for all this time. So I had enough money from the NFL and from the severance package to be able to kind of do nothing for a little bit, right? And a buddy of mine named Paul Sorkelson, he was like, look. So also at this time, and this is important, I was playing in the New York Gay Flag Football League.
Okay.
And I had met all these gay men, lesbian women, trans folks who I started to build a community with, right? So I was having more confidence. I was dating someone at the time. And Paul was like, why don't you go volunteer at an LGBT organization?
Wade says he went to a community organization for LGBTQ youth. He went in looking for a volunteer opportunity and wound up with a job.
What I didn't realize was that I would be working with so many amazing women who had master's degrees, doctorate degrees, and I was their de facto boss because I was an assistant director. And they hated me for that, right? Because what I also didn't understand was that I was given this job also because nonprofits need to fundraise. And you can utilize the name and likeness of a Black gay man who's a former NFL player to bring in donors because mm-hmm. people wanted to meet this UFO, or as my partner would call me in French, is I would be considered an OVNI, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what I didn't realize was because I didn't have formal education in this space and I was made the boss of a lot of folks who did, they were like, this is some BS. And I remember we were, a lot of the young kids who went there, they were between the ages of 12 and 24. Many of them were homeless or marginally housed. the large majority of these kids are kids of color. So we would serve dinner every night at around six. So this is the most chaotic time of the day, because for a lot of those kids, it was their only meal, right? So they're coming in and they want to make sure that they get their food. So we had to be hyper organized and diligent about how we brought them in and exited them out. And during this one day, I was in charge of the space, and the space was chaotic. And one of my colleagues, a brilliant woman named Erica, I gave her a directive. She disagreed with it. And we had a little bit of a back and forth. And I looked at her and I said, "Sweetie, I need you to calm down." And she looked at me with a level of, as Brittany Cooper might say, eloquent rage, and said, "Don't you ever call me sweetie." And instead of me having the courage to apologize, I retreated in what I call a good guy-ism. And I said, "You know what I mean. I'm a Southerner. Everybody uses the language of sweetie. That's not sexist, blah, 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 blah," right? So I'm trying to convince her that what I said isn't problematic.
Wade says his supervisor called him into her office to discuss the incident. She gave him a book about feminism by the author and activist Bell Hooks. Wade's supervisor made him read it not once, not twice, but three times until he came to a realization about himself.
So I go away, I read it a third time. About half of the way through the book, it dawns on me, and it came over me like a rush, that this book was not about women only, that it was not about Erica, that it was about me. That this book was about me, that what she was trying to get me to wrestle with was, as James Baldwin would say, that when I dehumanize another person, it says nothing about them, but it says everything about me. Mm-hmm. And that what I recognized was that even though the term sweetie in my mind was a universal term, I had never called a man sweetie in my whole life. I would never in the workplace call a man sweetie, right? So what I had to reckon with was my own sexism and patriarchal kind of practices that I was bringing into the workplace. And until I reconciled, like, where those practices, like where I learned them, until I reconciled, like, everything that that might say about me, I could never do the work well.
Right. In a lot of ways, when you were talking about her, I was like, reminds me of my doctoral advisors, which make you go back again and again because it's, you know, an iterative process. There's so much here to make it personal. And we talk a lot about that in our work in the DEI space of, yes, we know it's a business imperative. Yes, we know it's a talent and workforce imperative. It's a community imperative. It's a human imperative. It has to be personal. And when you talked about the power of feminism, it does get into those readings, understanding power, authority, identity, forms of privilege, and how people are navigating comfort and discomfort. And that it's really probably on a continuum, right? Comfort and discomfort.
Oh, yes.
Well, I was talking to you and you brought up something that I thought was really fascinating about this. A couple of things around the word use privilege. And what we're really trying to do when we're educating people from different backgrounds about not just walking a mile in someone's shoes, but to your point, opening your aperture so that you are able to see that your life and your life experiences are yours and that other people may be having a totally different experience. And can you become more aware and connected and informed and observant that your way of being, the way that you move and perform in the world, is not the same? So tell us, I want people to hear, because I heard it, the word privilege. What are your thoughts on that?
So when I think of the word privilege, And again, I learned this from reading a lot of Black feminist literature. I think of the word power. And power is defined as the ability to control the destiny of others, right? So when we use the language of privilege, like that's what we're really talking about, right? Is that primarily heterosexual white men, those who are tall, those who the world deem as attractive, right? Like those privileges that they have become power. Like, and that gives them the ability to control the destiny of others based on an idea that they are more competent, right? It's a fascinating thing that if you were to look at like at most of our presidents, even President Obama, right? Like tall, come from a certain educational background, mm-hmm. right? If you look at all of our Supreme Court justices, right? Even though you might see racial or gender differences, right? They all went to the same school. Like almost all of them went to a certain type of school, mm-hmm. right? So privilege looks certain types of ways. But what we're really talking about is like, who has the power to control somebody else's destiny? And what I want people to really wrestle with is that when I don't feel agency, when I don't have the power to move about the world free of the boot, right? My only natural response, right, is to respond in a way that highlights that you got your boot on my neck. Mm. You know? So when I think about my partner, he's French. He's from, I wouldn't say a rich background, but definitely he grew up with more funds than I did. But I remember it was on one of our first couple of dates. And he said, look, I know you see me as white, but I'm French first. And I thought to myself, well, what are you talking about? You know? And he said, when I came over to America, it was the first time that I consciously checked white on a box on any type of paper. Because in France, they don't actually collect racial data, mm-hmm. right? And I had to really think about that. And then I thought, huh, if I lived in Nigeria, I wouldn't think of myself as Black. I would think of myself as Nigerian. Mm-hmm. So what he helped me think about in that moment is that my experience in America is not a universal experience. Like right. There are multiple ways that one thinks about and sees the actual world. So when I think about trying to get those with privilege to own their privilege, I have to verbally articulate and own mine first, right? So as we said, I'm Black, I'm gay, I grew up poor, I grew up with a speech impediment, I'm an athlete, which comes with privileges, but it also comes with its stereotypes, right? Like, how do I own all of the power and the access that comes with some of those identities, right? But how do I also know that those identities are external things? Like they're given to me, like right. They're just labels.
They're on loan.
Yeah, right. But who I become is what happens to me because of those labels. So who I became is what happened to me because I was given the label of Black, of disabled, and of all of those things. And I had to decide for myself that those labels were what I was, but they were never who I was. That they were never who I am. And I get to decide that. I get to decide who I am.
Exactly. And that segues nicely into a conversation I want to have about inclusive workplaces and language and just where we are today. One mm-hmm. of the things that we talked about was the ability or inability for people who have a certain level of power and access to handle discomfort. Mm. And why is it that when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion and addressing it, it conjures up a heightened degree of discomfort and avoidance and resistance to the change that is needed to have all these slogans that we talk about, being able to bring your best self to work, wanting the best talent in the world, wanting to be this attractive employer of choice for women, for people of color, you know, for people with disabilities and veterans and, you know, LGBTQ plus, all of this. But there's a reticence, a resistance to the discomfort necessary for the change.
Yeah.
A lot of our work is so much time handling feelings and emotions and what I meant to say was, and I am in, I'm really a good person. I'm not bad. I'm not racist. I'm not this. I'm not sexist. I'm this good person. Why can't we just call a thing? And how do we help people start to really manage the fact that you cannot handle discomfort? And why can't they handle discomfort?
So there's a big difference between kindness and niceness.
Ooh.
And most of us sit in a space of niceness, right? Niceness is about being agreeable. It's about saying the right thing so that no one thinks that you're a bad person. Kindness is actually saying the thing that needs to be said because I trust that you as an adult, that you as an individual can handle it and can grow from it, right? So what my boss did when I used that patriarchal sexist language was she handled me with kindness. She trusted, right, that if she asked the right questions, if she gave me enough time, that I would grow, right? Mm-hmm. She was comfortable with my discomfort, right? So one of the things that people have to recognize is that we never grow when things are comfortable, right? As an athlete, any good teacher will always put you in a space of discomfort because that's where the growth happens. That's where the learning happens. Mm-hmm. And there's this exercise that I often do in the very beginnings of my trainings as we're trying to come up with the terms of engagement. So I'll ask everybody in the room who is able to sit, I will go, hey, when you sit down in your chair, did you check the legs of your chair to make sure that they were going to hold you up when you sat down? No one raises their hand. I go, great. All right. Well, did you call the architect or the boss of this company to make sure that the building plans have been checked to make sure that this building doesn't fall on you? And they go, well, no. And then I go, well, wait a minute. You wanted safety. You didn't question anybody to get that level of safety. And everybody goes, well, the reason I didn't check my chair when I sat down is because I'm used to sitting in chairs and those chairs functioning properly. So the question is, if you always sat down in a chair and the chair broke, what would you normally do?
Check
the legs of those chairs. You would check it, right? So what I want people to recognize is that they're always standing in a circumstance of risk, right? But we create certain habits that allow us to feel comfortable. I want us to figure out what are the places that I have high levels of discomfort and how can I sit in a circumstance of risk knowing that I'm going to grow there, but that I can't check every chair before you sit down in it. As competent as you and I are, as D&I folks, we can't make every chair safe, right? So the question is, what are your real needs, which is different from your wants? Right? Like, what are the real needs that you might need in order to do your work as great as possible? And what are the places where you are going to have to sit in a little bit of risk because there is no place that ever exists where there's going to be complete comfort? And that goes for all of us.
Exactly.
Not just our straight white men. That also goes for everyone who has other types of identities.
Standing in the circumstances of risk. I can't take what Netflix is doing around psychological safety or risk taking and say, we're going to do that over here at MetLife. Exactly. I have to understand the realities and the context of the experience that the people are having in my own space. So with that, in my own organization. But what are the essential things that if I'm going to even attract people to come into this space, as a corporation, as organizational leadership, what is the essence? What would the Davis hallmarks of inclusion be that we must have? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. The number one thing is your leadership has to make the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion personal to them. Meaning that if I were to come into your workplace, your C-suite plus two needs to be able to articulate why having an inclusive, having a representative environment makes them better as leaders, makes the people who they engage with better, makes the corporate culture better, and then actually makes the business better. That should be the last answer that that should be given, right? Because if every leader doesn't have their origin story to why inclusion matters, it becomes a nice to have and not a must have, right? Every leader needs to be able to, I should be able to go, huh, walk me through when inclusion became personal or intimate to you. Right. And that leader should be able to do that. So, and not to brag on us at Netflix, but every leader in our product department and many leaders throughout our entire organization has a diversity, equity, and inclusion coach. So every vice president sits with someone on my team, and for 45 minutes to an hour every month, they go through coaching just like someone would have an executive coach. And we try to up level their competencies in four spaces: in the space of courage, compassion, consciousness, and competence. So that means that we have leaders who, similar to you and I, could articulate not just what the definition of intersectionality is, not just who Kimberly Crenshaw is, but could also tell you who Emma DeGraffenried is, to understand like how that word was even birthed, and then how that word intersects with their daily lives.
Intersectionality is the way identities overlap and compound one another to create different systems of inequality and disadvantage. Emma DeGraffenried was the plaintiff in one of the first lawsuits that brought up the issue. She and several other Black women sued General Motors for discrimination. They claimed that they couldn't get jobs because of their intersecting identities. The company hired Black men and they hired women, but they didn't hire Black women. The women lost the lawsuit in 1976 because the court found that they couldn't combine race and gender claims. Kimberly Crenshaw coined the term intersectionality over 10 years later in 1989.
We've got to make the work of inclusion a leadership imperative. It's got to be a core competency, just like being able to communicate effectively, to collaborate, to understand certain business things, right? Because here's the example that I use for folks often. If I'm the CEO of a company and I have someone who is in charge of mergers and acquisition, right? And we're thinking about acquiring another business, another large business, right? I would not leave it to that M&A person to execute this large deal, right? Because me as the CEO, I would understand that if this didn't go well, I would be held responsible, right? When you're doing the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion, you're doing another form of a merger and an acquisition. That's what you're actually doing, right? So why should the CEO hand that off to you, Cindy? Hand that off to right. me. They have got to be part and parcel. They have got to be just as competent in this space as you and I are.
Absolutely. Everything that you said, I just thank you for that. As you said, it's a leadership imperative and leadership at all levels. We can't just only look to our CEO, executive leadership team, senior leadership teams, senior management teams, whatever you call it. We can't just say it rests with them or it rests with my manager. That's why this podcast is called Inclusion Begins With Me, because it is personal and the work of leadership has to start from the inside to go out. So two things I want to cover before we close out. One is there's a calling on us to be more inclusive from a language standpoint and really become more aware and intentional about the words and the language that we might be using in our sphere, in our job descriptions, in our marketing materials may not be inclusive. People are being asked to use pronouns. I had someone ask me the other day, why are we doing that? And I was like, why would we not be doing that? So I want to get your insight on, as we have four generations in the workplace, it is my feeling that the millennials as well as Gen Zers are having requirements that maybe the generations prior, our generation, maybe boomers and those before, may not have, they had different requirements, but there is a huge push for, I want language that is inclusive of everyone here. How do we do that as organizations? Any insights around whether it's pronouns, whether it's job descriptions, just language in general, how do we get more educated and what are the steps we need to take?
Yeah, so my partner has really helped me understand the importance of language, because what language indicates is one's mindset and one's history and understanding of who they are. The reason why language also matters is that, so when you were a child and you first started to call something a chair or a TV or a phone or a lamp, right? What you're doing is you're naming things in order to control it. And that's what naming things are, right? So if I want you to call me by my correct pronoun, what I'm trying to do is take ownership and control of my life and my name, mm-hmm. right? So language matters because people are trying to, as we said earlier, right, to control their destiny, right? Because if I can call a chair, right, that means that I am able to take part in the engagement with that thing that I'm calling an actual chair or calling a person the actual correct type of pronoun. Now, the work, though, is to have a certain level of patience and compassion for people who actually are on their journey to understanding the newness of certain words and certain lexicons, right? Because even though I may be someone who is super comfortable with the introduction of something like pronouns, that doesn't mean that the other person is going to be comfortable at the same time, right? So a quick example, when I told my mother that I was gay and she reacted in a negative way, my hope was that she would accept me tomorrow, right? But if I had 25 years to get comfortable with the idea of being gay, I can't expect her to be comfortable with the idea of me being gay at the exact same rate. So when we're introducing new words, new lexicons, right, we've got to recognize that if I'm comfortable with this word now, that doesn't mean that everyone else will be comfortable at the same pace. So what does it mean to have some grace and space for exactly. folks who are just being introduced to these new terms to get comfortable too?
Absolutely. So we have to be mindful and we have to be open. And as you've talked about, it might be uncomfortable, but it's part of the learning process. And I always say discomfort is a necessary sacrifice for the work that has to take place. Mm. So I rather, you know, because I think sometimes people might look at us, Wade, and say, Cindy and Wade are never uncomfortable. I would like people to know that I live in discomfort every single day. I am nervous about what I might say, how I may have mispronounced someone's name. Did I say something that is culturally inappropriate that was appropriate 5 minutes ago, but was canceled out and I did not get the memo that this word is no longer acceptable? Those are things that we have to manage. Did I miss someone, omit the contributions of someone in a meeting? Did I overlook things because it was through my lens that I didn't understand and see what other people meant? Exactly. So every single day I'm trying to manage, and it's not about making a mistake because I know I will make mistakes, but it's, did I intentionally not show up being an ally, being an upstander, and being truly committed to this work? I want to hear, how do you manage your own discomfort? And what should we expect in the next 10 to 15 years in this space? What should we be looking for and helping shape in terms of the systemic change we need to make in DEI?
That's a big question. That's a big question. When it comes to how I handle making mistakes, a colleague of mine, Julia Stern, they helped me understand this. I actually expect to make a mistake. Right. Like, I don't expect to be perfect, because perfection is actually not the ask in the work of DEI. The ask is that you stay in it, right? The ask is to stay humble. The ask is to stay curious, right? So when I make a mistake, what I try to do is I would say, hey, Cindy, I recognize that you gave me some feedback about something that I said that was wrong. If you're okay, I would love to go away, spend some time trying to educate myself so I lessen the likelihood that I make the mistake again. But I would love to come back in a week or a month or whatever and have a conversation and help you understand what I learned about the mistake, right? Because what I'm trying to do is rebuild that trust that I lost by actually doing the act that was harmful in the first place, right? So imagine if that was the posture that most of us sat in and not sat in a posture of defensiveness. So the first thing is to expect to make mistakes, own the mistake and own the mistake publicly, right? So what does it mean if I feel bad internally, but you sending you just like, man, like Wade, he did X or he did Y and he never owned it, right? Like you now don't have any faith that I'm going to grow from the actual mistake. But to your larger question around like, what can we do from a systemic standpoint? I think if we want to change institutions, I think that we have got to understand where we come from, like at a real honest level, to be able to know where we're going, right? So we've got to be educated more on the history, but not look at the history trying to look at it in this really kind of a simplified way, right? So we could look at homophobia in this very narrow way and say, oh, straight people are so terrible. Or we can have a little bit of grace and go, the language, the ideas, the freedoms that we experience now was not the freedoms, the language that they experienced before. So how do we have a certain level of compassion, right?
Exactly.
For that, this is on a spectrum and a journey, right? And then how do we look at our practices, our processes with much more rigor, mm-hmm. and say, how can I add another layer of rigor to each of these processes that lessens the likelihood that people are impacted by it? And then the last thing that I would say is that how do we tie DE&I to business and leadership competencies and outcomes in a way that at some point, right, if leaders aren't getting better, right, you are held accountable so that people go, wow, this thing that I thought, again, was a nice to have is a must have. And if I don't get better at it, I can't be a better leader, right? Because people should expect that they're going to have to lead teams of women, that they're going to have to exactly. lead teams of folks of color, that they're going to have to lead teams of disabled folks, right? So if folks go, this is something that I'm going to be assessed against, therefore I've got to get better at it, right? So just like when you're hiring someone, you're assessing them for lots of other competencies. How do we start to assess leaders for their inclusivity, right? Start to ask those types of historical questions like, hey, walk me through with great levels of specificity how you have historically created a culture on your team of inclusion. What have you done as a leader to increase the representation on your team? And if people don't start to have great answers, they don't get hired. Now you start to make those a new demand, right? And it's not that I'm punishing you for not blah, blah, blah. So someone can actually say, hey, historically, I have not been able to increase my representation. But if I get the opportunity, here are the three things that I would do differently because I've done the work to learn about mm-hmm. what I should have did, right? So it's not about punishing you because maybe historically your teams weren't X, Y, or Z, but it's the questions are like, what would you do differently now that you have grown? So like, that's how we start to really start to institutionalize the value of inclusion, because when you're being hired, you're going to be assessed for it.
Wade, that is it. You dropped a lot of gems. I mean, there were like several mic drop moments all throughout the podcast. You didn't hear the mic drop, everyone, because we kept talking, but it was an emoticon mic drop. This one here that you just dropped, this to me is the foundational thing that organizations can do now to see the change that they want to have in 10 to 15 years. Because being able to have leadership traits, behaviors, and competencies be in alignment and say, here's what is expected from an inclusion standpoint, inclusivity, as you talked about, being able to measure that, here's where you are, here's where we need you to be, and here's how we're going to build those capabilities. And at the foundation, to be in this company, you have to be an inclusive leader.
Exactly.
Wade, who did not leave us in the water, Davis. Wade in the water. We didn't wait. We stood. And we've learned a lot about who we need to be, accepting who we are, and bringing that into this powerful work. Thank you so much. I can't wait for people to hear this podcast.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you all for joining me on this episode of Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter. Wade Davis is a thought leader, public speaker, and a writer on gender, race, and orientation equality. Links to learn more about Wade and his work are in our show notes. Learn more about MetLife's commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion on MetLife.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. I hope you also take the time to rate and leave our show a review. Before we go, we'd like to thank our podcast partner, Human Group Media, who helped us produce this show. That's it for today. I hope you join me next month for a brand new episode.